If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I've got this sort of, you know, quiet campaign that I want to get philosophy back on the streets where it belongs, and to have a philosopher on every street corner, so that, you know, we all have a Socrates or a Confucius or a Buddha in our lives.
That was Bethany Hughes talking about her new TV series on great philosophers.
Poor unfortunate would be lunatic would be locked inside and lowered below the water, and then brought back up and revived, and again, a sort of shock treatment.
And that was Andrew Scull, on one of the methods once used to cure insanity. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our fifth podcast of July 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History magazine. Next Wednesday, on the 5th of August, a new series begins on BBC 4, entitled Genius of the Ancient World. Presented by the historian and broadcaster Bethany Hughes, it profiles three of the greatest thinkers of antiquity: the Buddha, Confucius, and Socrates. Three men who all lived at around the same time, and whose legacies are still hugely important today. I spoke to Bethany recently about the series, and I began by asking her why she had picked out these three philosophers for the series.
I've spent 10 years or so writing about the philosopher Socrates, the Greek philosopher, so I feel that I know him very well. I've lived with him for a decade. And he seemed to me such an extraordinary character, this big thinker whose ideas have impacted on the civilizations of both the East and the West. But what really struck me when I was doing the Socrates research was that we often seem to forget he's just a real ordinary man. You know, he lived and died, he was flawed, he had problems in his life, and his philosophy is also very practical. It's very much about helping people in the day-to-day. So I kind of had a sense that these philosophers needed to be brought down from the kind of lofty heights of the sky and back onto the streets in a way where they belong. So having done all this Socrates work, I looked at what other people were thinking at the same time. And there is this extraordinary coincidence that the Buddha and Confucius and Socrates all live and die within around about 100 years of one another. Some people call this the axial age. You know, they talk about this kind of moment when the world changed. I'm actually more interested in looking at each of them as individuals and seeing what their philosophy can tell us today. And what has been fascinating doing that is finding out really what extraordinary comparisons there are between them, and how even though they lived thousands of miles apart and as far as we know didn't have any direct contact with one another, nor indeed, you know, communicated via messenger, via kind of the equivalent of the pigeon post of the ancient world, they do have very similar approaches to life and to the problems and delights of being human. So it seemed to be a very interesting thing to put these three together: Socrates from Greece, the Buddha from the Indian subcontinent, and Confucius from China, and to try to understand this moment that changed the world.
You said that, you know, they didn't meet each other or anything, but do you think it is coincidence that they appeared at the same time, or were there any, say, global trends that might have allowed for these three great thinkers arriving at the same sort of time?
I don't think it is coincidence. I think there is a kind of quantum shift in civilization around this time. If you look at what's happening for all three men in their own historical time, things are changing. All three lived through times of great flux and challenge, so they lived in difficult times. And something that you see emerging from this moment of change is the birth of cities, for instance. So not just little citadels, but real cities. And this means a lot of things. It means that people are suddenly being cut loose from their family or tribal ties, which have really dominated life for the millennia before. You get a new class, you get a merchant class who are moving and trading between these cities. And these are men who physically have money in their pockets. Coined money really starts to circulate in all three of these cultures, in the Chinese, the Indian subcontinent, and the Eastern Mediterranean at this time. So you almost have the sense that you have these men who are economic actors who have a kind of feeling that they have a bit more control over their own life, and that there is potential to fulfill your human potential in the here and now. So you're not just living at the whim of the gods or of nature, but there's a chance that you can use your spirit and your mind and your ideas to impact on the world around you. So all three of them share that. So I think it is absolutely no coincidence that they come up with these big, bold, radical ideas at the time. Either they're responding to their age and or they are a product of it, I think. So it's a very, very exciting moment in human history.
And you said that they shared some similarities in their ideas. Could you give us some examples of some of the most pronounced ones?
Yes, I mean, they're great. I've now become completely, I'm a sort of adherent of these three, you know, I'm totally converted, and they're kind of philosophically, much of what they say is now ruling my life. I just think they have the most brilliant advice for us in the 21st century. So all of them say, look, you know, wealth isn't necessarily a bad thing, but the immoderate pursuit of wealth is bad. So you should never pursue wealth at the expense of wisdom. You know, and sitting here today with Greece collapsing around me, you just think, well, that wouldn't it be good if we all took a moment and thought, actually, has somebody down the line been pursuing wealth in an immoderate way? They're very exciting because they say that education is important, sharing ideas, communicating is vital. But what you should never do is just learn by rote. You should constantly interrogate and question the world around you. Socrates famously says the unexamined life is not worth living for a man. And that seems to me crucial as well, that you're not trying to completely tear up the rule book. You're not trying to create anarchy. You're not trying to destroy everything that's gone before. But you're also saying, actually, let's just have a look at this from another point of view. You know, is there a better way that we can understand how to live? So that seems to me, again, a kind of wonderfully modern and empowering and invigorating way to approach life. They all love wisdom. They talk about wisdom being beauty. And they also say that each and every one of us can literally be a philosopher. We can all be a lover of wisdom. But I think the final thing, to be honest, that speaks to me most powerfully, again, that they all absolutely support and nourish, is the idea that none of us live in isolation, that it's not really that man is the measure of all things, but man's relationship with man. And that what we each need to do is to be as individually good as we possibly can be. And then there's a kind of natural logic that the world will be good. So they all say, kind of look to yourself, and that's how you can solve the problems of the universe. And they do it. And this, you know, there's always a danger. This sounds a bit kind of hippie and 60s. What they all say is the mechanism for this is to have an ethical framework to your life and also to love. And I don't mean a kind of soppy romantic love or a kind of sexy erotic love. It's really a love of life, a love of being human, and a love of humanity around you. So Socrates, for instance, says, love is the one thing I understand. I have never known a time when I was not in love with somebody. The Buddha, in one of the earliest bits of writing we have of his, says love without limit. And Confucius has this brilliant kind of notion to guide us, which is called Ren or Zhen, depending how you transliterate it from the Chinese characters, which sort of means compassion, a kind of human-heartedness that you always have to think, am I acting in a way that is good for the rest of humanity? And I think it is pretty hard to argue with those ideas.
And as you say, these ideas are very much pertinent to our lives in the 21st century. How important were these thinkers actually in their own age to the people around them?
Really interesting question. We know that they were very charismatic. All three of them seem to have this quality. People talk about, you know, their followers being kind of desperate to spend time with them and hanging on their every word. And they all attract followers. That's what's very interesting. They have almost these kind of disciples who follow them around. And the fact that even though none of them wrote anything down in their own lifetime, as far as we know, or at least it hasn't survived, we're pretty sure they didn't write anything down. The fact that we have their words and ideas and their life stories is because those that went after them loved them so much and were so inspired by them that they set their ideas and their narratives down. So we know that they had an impact on those immediately around them. But in a way, you could say that certainly Confucius and Socrates failed in their quest to encourage people to live a good, a virtuous, a soulful life. Confucius dies very depressed, and he says, you know, age 73, it's time for me to die. I failed in my task because I haven't persuaded the rulers of China to kind of follow this virtuous, gentlemanly role. Socrates famously is killed by the Athenian city-state. He goes on trial for speaking his mind freely. He's accused of corrupting the young, of pursuing his own divinities, of degrading the divinities of Athens, and he's put to trial. He's convicted and he dies in a prison cell. It's legally, it's not execution, it's actually state-sponsored suicide. So he is put to death for his ideas. And although the Buddha's ideas are carried on by the Sangha, and we have these stories that when he was teaching, people were sort of thousands would go over to Buddhism. Actually, it's not until 200 years or so after his death with the Emperor Ashoka that actually Buddhism really becomes a central part of that whole region of the world. So in a way, they all died unsuccessful. And yet, isn't it extraordinary that 25 centuries on, they are still household names and we're still talking about them?
Have they always been well known, or were they like rediscovered? For example, was there a renaissance for these people?
There was more of a renaissance for the Buddha. So the Buddha's ideas that were hugely, hugely impactful, important, and widely disseminated right up until the 11th century AD. And then he has this kind of dark period where the Buddhist temples are closed down, Buddhist universities are burnt down. His ideas are really, really kind of suppressed, and they don't have so much influence. Socrates and Confucius are rather different, though. Really interestingly, pretty quickly after Socrates' death, the Athenians realise that they've made a mistake. We're told that they erect a statue of him outside the city walls. And Plato, of course, picks up his trail and creates the Platonic Socratic dialogues that tell us so much about him and his approach to life. And those are very, very popular throughout time in both the East and the West. And that's something we absolutely have to remember about Socrates in particular, that he's not a Western philosopher. He was hugely influential, him and Plato's ideas, in Islamic culture, for instance. Aflatones is the kind of Arabic version of the word Plato. And there's loads of little kids all around today called Aflatones, loads of little Platos running around. Confucius, very interestingly, again, there's a kind of gap when it looks like his ideas are going to die. And then the emperors of China actually realize that it probably is worthwhile not just trying to rule with a fist of iron, but trying to rule virtuously, that this might have benefits. And so Confucian ideas have become a central part of Chinese civilization and culture. And because his notion was that everybody, and actually all three of them say this, that this isn't just a kind of philosophy for the great and the good, for the educated. This is something that every single man and woman, indeed, should take part in. Then you find right across China, even the uneducated learning Confucian quotes and Confucian ideas. So you know that rather kind of hackneyed phrase when we say Confucius, he say. Well, actually, it was a kind of 1,000 years of Chinese history where everybody were speaking Confucius's ideas kind of on every street corner. So it was something which was absolutely stitched into the kind of character of Chinese society. So that was very, very, it was very popular. It then, though, took on in China in particular. It took on, as with all of these ideas, again, they become corrupted. People use them for their own ends. And it was then thought to be part of a more sterile, suppressive, kind of top-down authoritarian rule. So very kind of convenient for those emperors to say, by the way, you have to be obedient, you have to respect your elders, you know, you have to respect those in the hierarchy above you. And so with communism, Confucius suddenly became a kind of enemy of the state, and he was thought to represent the bad old days. His ideas were, physically they were burnt, the manuscripts were torn up. So we don't actually have that many manuscripts talking about Confucius from that period. His gravestone was toppled. The gravestones of other Confucian scholars were destroyed. And I've been to that cemetery making this series, and it's incredibly moving, actually, looking at what happens when a very rigid form of an ideology becomes an enemy of ideas. But he's now having a resurgence, Confucius. There are Confucius Institutes all around the world, sponsored by the Chinese state. And there are lots of Confucian schools. So we go and we have a lovely time in China going and seeing these great kids. Very funny. You know, ordinary teenage boys and girls just sitting and learning 21st century old philosophies and ideas. The teenage boys dressed in these sort of Confucian cloaks and with these slightly daft Confucian hats on. It was very funny walking into that classroom, because there they were all reciting this kind of beautiful ancient poetry and philosophy, and there was a distinct smell of sweaty trainers. I thought, you know, that's a room full of boys anywhere in the world. They might be wearing hats and quoting old philosophy, but you can still smell the teenage boy in there. But actually, they're all very proud of Confucius, and he has this brilliant, the kind of golden rule of Confucius is basically our do as you would be done by. Actually, in the original, it's kind of inverted, and it's do not do to others what you do not wish to happen to yourself. But that seems to me, again, a kind of just brilliantly simple totem for life, that we should always remember we should act in the world as we want the world to be. And genuinely, there are 3,000 Confucian schools in China, and these kids really seem to be, you know, inspired and motivated by spending time with those Confucian ideas.
You talked about how Confucius in particular, how he connected with other ideologies. What impact did the rise of the great monotheistic religions have on the ideas of these three?
Well, it's very interesting because monotheism is rising at the same time that these three are flourishing. If you look at what's happening in Judaism, you know, that's happening almost at exactly the parallel time with all three. And again, Christianity, if you look at Socrates, for instance, a lot of his ideas people think are really prefiguring what you end up hearing in Christianity. Socrates is very clear, for instance, that punishment should not be about revenge, you know, whereas this was totally the norm in the ancient world, the idea is that you punish people in order to have revenge on them. He says, no, punishment should really be about educating your soul so that you don't make the same mistake another time in the future, which is immensely progressive. So there's a kind of interesting crossover with a lot of monotheistic ideas. And so all three of them, although they're obviously pagan philosophers, so they can't become officially part of the canon, the very fact that they are preserved tells us that those monotheistic cultures could see the value in what they were writing. And there's this whole movement of Neoplatonic thought, which has a kind of crossover with Christianity, when Plato's words are kind of quoted and studied over by the early medieval and then the Renaissance scholars. So they're almost, they talked so much about being good and using our time on earth to change things that they kind of interleave rather nicely with monotheism, so they're not left out completely in the cold.
One thing that I think is really interesting is that in many other fields we've had, you know, a lot of progress, like technology and science and industry, but yet with philosophy it still seems that nobody really has come and superseded these people. Why do you think we haven't necessarily progressed in terms of philosophy?
What a good thought. I'd say it's because the genius of these men is that they don't set out to completely change the world. They're kind of radicals who don't want a revolution, in a way. What they do is they recognise the world for what it is. And that means they recognise us as a species for what we are. And we are still the same species now as we were 25 centuries ago. So in many ways, almost without exception, their ideas are as applicable now as they were 25 centuries ago. So I think in a way, we don't necessarily, you know, they got there. they got there 25 centuries ago. We don't need to improve. We need to do as they did, to question, to interrogate, to kind of ask questions of their philosophies. But we don't need to kind of completely eradicate them or leave them behind just as a kind of historical artifact. What I do think, though, and I think we do this at our peril, is that we're very keen on asking the what and the how, but not the why about our lives. I've sat on so many committees, kind of funding committees and educational committees and city committees and arts committees, and you think you desperately need a philosopher around the table, actually, where there is somebody saying, oh, this is all very well, all very interesting, the details really important, but where is the good in this? What is going to be, what's going to be the outcome that will actually benefit humanity from what we're talking about? So I've got this sort of, you know, quiet campaign that I want to get philosophy back on the streets where it belongs, and to have a philosopher on every street corner, so that, you know, we all have a Socrates or a Confucius or a Buddha in our lives.
Just one last question, Bethany. If somebody, after watching your programmes, would like to know more about these philosophers, is there any particular books or writings of theirs you'd recommend they read?
Definitely go straight to the source. So go to the Confucian Analects, which were written down and collated only about 100 years after his death. Go to Plato's Dialogues. they're just hilarious. They're brilliantly, mischievously written. And go to the Buddhist Pali canons, which are, again, the kind of first, earliest versions of what he's writing down. The Open University is sponsoring this series, and they've got a fantastic website with all sorts of materials as well. So if you go to the Open University and just click on the links, kind of, that we'll make sure those are all available whenever you watch the programme or look online, then they're going to have a whole series of books and recommended reading and courses that you can do. So it's only the beginning of the learning journey. This is it. It just starts here.
That was Bethany Hughes. Genius of the Ancient World begins next Wednesday, the 5th of August, on BBC 4 at 9 p.m. And the first episode will tell the story of the Buddha. And now we have a short advertisement break.
From ancient Rome to the Tudor court, revolutionary Paris to the Second World War, discover the best historical fiction and non-fiction at H for History. Visit us today for exclusive author features, first chapter previews, podcasts and audio excerpts, book trailers, giveaways, and much more. Sign up now to receive our regular newsletter at www.hforhistory.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our digital editor, Emma McFarnan.
Scientists believe they have identified the remains of four men who were among the early leaders of Virginia's Jamestown settlement. The bodies were exhumed in November 2013 in the church where Pocahontas married Captain John Rolfe in 1614, BBC News reports. After 2 years of detective work, researchers have concluded that the badly preserved bones belong to important figures who lived in Jamestown between 1607 and 1610, when the colony almost collapsed amid food shortages, disease, and Indian attacks. Jamestown was the first successful British colony that gave rise to modern-day America. Perhaps the most important of the four individuals identified is Captain Gabriel Archer, who led some of the first expeditions up the James River seeking gold and silver. In other news, a paw print made by a cat in Roman times has been discovered on a roof tile in Gloucester. The 2,000-year-old tile was dug up in Berkeley Street in 1969, but it was only recently that the paw print was found by an archaeologist at Gloucester City Museum, who was examining thousands of fragments of Roman roof tiles. According to BBC News, the cat is thought to have snuck across wet tiles that were drying in the sun in about AD 100. While boot print and dog paw prints have been found on tiles from Roman Gloucester before, cat prints are said to be very rare. Meanwhile, a 98-year-old veteran of the Second World War Arctic convoys has finally been awarded a medal for his heroism. George Morris was 21 when he sailed on what Winston Churchill called, quote, the worst journey in the world, the Mirror reports. More than 3,000 British and Allied sailors died when their ships were torpedoed by U-boats, sunk by German battleships, or bombed by Nazi planes as they carried vital aid to the Soviet Union from 1941 to 1945. But their efforts were not honoured with medals when peace came, because the Soviet wartime ally had become a Cold War enemy. The Arctic Star was created only 2 years ago following a long campaign, and now, 70 years after the conflict, George Morris has received his medal.
Thanks for that, Emma. Before our next interview, here's a reminder that tickets are currently on sale for our 2015 History Weekends that take place in York and Malmesbury from the 25th to the 27th of September and the 15th to 18th of October. Before our next interview, here's a reminder that tickets are currently on sale for our 2015 History Weekends that take place in York and Malmesbury from the 25th to the 27th of September and the 15th to 18th of October, respectively. We have a great range of speakers that includes Michael Wood, Susanna Lipscomb, Alison Weir, Tom Holland and Helen Castor. Tickets are on sale now and you can get hold of them and find out more details at historyweekend.com. And if you're not able to make it up to York for our weekend there, then you can also catch a number of historians, including Simon Sharma and Tracy Borman, at the Radio Times Festival, which takes place on the 24th to 27th of September at Hampton Court Palace. You can find out more details and purchase tickets at radiotimesfestival.com. And I should mention that the festival, like the magazine, is run by Immediate Media, the company which also publishes BBC History magazine. Our second interview this month is with Professor Andrew Scull, author of a recently published book that explores changing attitudes to mental health over the last 3,000 years, from the Bible to the so-called madhouses of the 19th century. Our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman, spoke to Professor Scull to find out more.
Firstly, the best thing to start off with is to ascertain what your understanding of the term madness is. I mean, it's not really a term we see used very much these days.
Yes. So the title of my book is Madness in Civilization, and it provides a cultural history of insanity from the very earliest times, from the Bible on to the present. And in choosing the word madness, I spent quite a bit of time thinking about that issue because it's become almost a taboo word these days, whereas for the great bulk of the historical arc that I'm trying to talk about, it was the term everybody used, whether they be physicians or divines or ordinary people. Madness was what they called it. In the course of the 19th century, that gradually came to be a term that was inappropriate, was not used by the professionals who once upon a time had themselves been called mad doctors and who now wanted to be called something else. And there was quite a dispute in the 19th century about what that should be in the English-speaking world. They didn't like the term psychiatrist, which was a German invention. And it wasn't until the very late 19th or early 20th century that alienist or asylum superintendent gradually began to be replaced with the term we use today, namely psychiatrist. So madness is a controversial term to use in the 21st century, yet oddly enough, it's also the term that patients who reject modern psychiatry, the people who call themselves psychiatric survivors sometimes, have appropriated for themselves, just as, for example, other previously stigmatized groups sometimes proudly use the term that stigmatized them once upon a time. So madness is the historically appropriate term for most of the period I'm talking about.
The book covers a huge breadth of history, sort of 3,000 years. Going right back to the beginning, how were people seen in the ancient world, you know, people who were deemed insane?
Well, as we can see, in the Bible, which is an interesting look back into a rather ancient tribal society, madness could sometimes acquire quite positive meanings, and it was often unclear what meanings to attach to people who seemed to think, to behave, to see, to hear things that the rest of us occupying what we assume is a common sense world simply don't share. So it was possible for people sometimes to be seen as channeling God, to be talking to God, to be prophets. But those same people might, under other circumstances, be seen as deranged. And madness could very often be seen, as we see with Saul, the first king of the Jews, as we see, for example, with Nebuchadnezzar, who takes the Jews off to captivity in Babylon. Those are figures we see being made mad by Yahweh, by a jealous God who tried to teach them a lesson when they behaved in ways he didn't approve of. So that's one form of belief that was very common, this idea of either madness as an affliction from God or as the result of the intervention of the devil, some sort of possession, or as the result of spells being cast, of witchcraft. And that has a long, convoluted history right down into the 18th century. There's a kind of larger set of meanings which to some extent coexist rather uneasily. And we can see that stretching down into the early modern period. Even in medieval times, we have much of madness interpreted through a religious lens, but gradually physicians begin to assert that at least some madness has a bodily cause. And then there's a question of where to draw the lines. Priests assert that madness is divinely or devilishly brought about. Doctors try to proclaim a different approach. And both sides for a time agree that there are cases of madness that belong in the religious sphere and other cases that belong in the medical sphere. It's only over an extended period of time, of course, that the medical beliefs tend to triumph and these alternative meanings come to seem culturally much less acceptable and believable.
Obviously, you've done a tremendous amount of research that's gone into the book. Some of the treatments that you discuss as sort of these cures or ways of curing madness, some of them are quite bizarre. Some of them sort of seem almost like, more like punishments than ways to cure. What are the kind of the more unusual cases and treatments that you've come across?
You often wonder whether the treatment is madder than the patients when you look at these things. For a long time, exorcism, religious kinds of treatments of one sort and another were very common. The medical treatments, such as they were for much of history, in the Western world at least, invoked the same kinds of things that we use to treat physical illness, just as Hippocratic and Galenic doctors, those who used humoral approaches, thought that the best way was to bleed and to purge and to vomit. So those things were used for madness. In the 18th century, as the Industrial Revolution arises and people become technologically more inventive, we see some quite extraordinary things. Erasmus Darwin, Charles's grandfather, who's a very prominent physician in the Midlands, revived something the Romans had used, swinging as a remedy. And he devises, although he doesn't build it himself, these swinging chairs where you could twirl people around at rapid speeds, sometimes reverse directions, or put them through a kind of loop-de-loop. And in the process, they would vomit, they would evacuate their bowels, they'd pee, they'd lose consciousness. They were frightened, and the idea was that this treatment operated on both the body and the psyche simultaneously to kind of shock the mad back to sanity. There was an elaborate near-drowning device developed in this period, often called the Chinese temple, which looked a bit like an elevator with a kind of iron cage that was built over a pond, and the poor unfortunate lunatic would be locked inside and lowered below the water and then brought back up and revived, and again, a sort of shock treatment. If we think of that as, oh, well, that's the superstitions of the 18th century, and we move to the 20th century, we can see treatments like putting people into a coma by injecting them with insulin and keeping them in a coma for an extended period and then reviving them with a shot of glucose. Insulin coma therapy was introduced in the 30s and didn't die out till sometime in the 50s, in some places even the 60s. It was used on the subject of Sylvia Nasse's book, A Beautiful Mind. John Nash, who, as you probably know, won a Nobel Prize in mathematics. We used brain surgery, the infliction of damage on the frontal lobes of the human brain, called leucotomy in Europe or lobotomy here in America, and the idea that we would slice the brain in some crude fashion and thereby cure madness now seems to us quite bizarre, but it won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1949. So there, and perhaps another 20th century example, the only one of these extraordinary treatments that persists into the present is ECT, originally known as electroshock therapy, then electroconvulsive therapy. Now the convulsions are controlled with muscle relaxants, so they don't even surface so obviously. But that's a treatment that we have no clue why it works, but many patients and doctors swear by it as a measure to treat depression. There are, it's fair to say as well, other patients and doctors who swear at it. But it nonetheless does survive as a reputable treatment in many circles today. And I suspect in a few centuries it will look rather bizarre, rather like those drowning devices I spoke of a few minutes ago.
Just sort of going back to the 19th century, it tends to be, when you think about madness in history, you tend to sort of focus on the lunatic asylum, places like Bedlam. You know, what sort of role and impact have they had on this history?
Well, you speak of Bedlam. Bedlam has a very, very old history. It was one of a number of medieval hospitals that emerged in that time. And the root of hospital and hospitality are the same, and that should cue us in. The earliest hospitals were religious rather than medical institutions. They took in travelers and pilgrims as well as people who were physically ill, and in the case of Bedlam, increasingly mentally ill. And the history of Bedlam dates back over 750 years now. It's obviously become almost synonymous with the asylum in the English-speaking world. But the real age of the asylum is, as you said when you asked me this question, the real age of the asylum emerges in the 19th century. All across Europe and North America, that's the period when the mad are scooped up and put into these institutions. And when the asylum is first born in the first three or four decades of that century, it's associated with very utopian claims about its status, about what it can accomplish. The asylum itself is seen as a therapeutic device, as the place where madness can go to be cured via a kind of manipulation of the environment and the sort of psychosocial reality that the mental patient experiences. So the expectation when the first asylums are built are that they will in fact cure mad men and women in very large numbers. And initially they seem to be relatively effective. Over time, that initial effect dies away, and increasingly the asylum comes to assume a very dark identity, a place where once you're admitted, you're never going to be released. It was never entirely accurate, but as chronic patients accumulated in the 19th century, it was the image of mental illness that began to be very widespread once again. And it was associated with the rise of extremely negative views about the origins of madness, seeing it as an example of evolution run in reverse, as it were, degeneration to some savage or even pre-human state. And in the 20th century, in the hands of the Nazis, that led to some terrible things being done. If you see the mentally ill as hopelessly biologically inferior, as almost a different species, as impossible to cure, as even people you don't want to cure because they'll go out and breed and produce yet more defectives, the danger is very, very much that you'll see the mad as nothing but a burden and as people who perhaps should be eliminated. And that's exactly what happened in Germany. They originally started sterilizing people and then moved to killing them in the hundreds of thousands. And it was, in fact, that program that was called T4 in Nazi Germany that developed the very techniques and even the trained manpower, if that's the term we can use in this awful context, that then was transferred to the death camps and used on Jews and other people the Nazis regarded as undesirable. So the mentally ill suffered a kind of Holocaust in Germany before anybody else. I should say, though, that this language of seeing the mentally ill as subhuman was widespread in Anglo-American society and in France and elsewhere in the late 19th, early 20th century. And the sterilizations, at least, were adopted quite enthusiastically in parts of the United States, particularly in California, where I live. California was indeed the model for the Nazis' sterilization law. So we should be aware that it was a close-run thing even in the democracies as to whether the mentally ill might not have suffered an even more dreadful fate than they often did. So asylums began in the early 19th century as quite small institutions modeled on a sort of family or small community approach to managing the mentally ill. As the century wore on, they grew quite enormous. And some of them began to contain 2, 3, 4, 5, even 10,000 patients. The largest such asylum that I'm aware of out on Long Island once contained almost 30,000 patients. So these were like towns almost. They had their own sources of gas, and when electric light came in, electricity, their own water supply, their own fire department, their own security force. People lived there from admission very often to the grave, and the doctors and the attendants who dealt with these patients also lived on the grounds and in many ways were almost as incarcerated, as it were, as the patients were. So really a huge physical presence. And what's remarkable, of course, is from the mid-20th century on, their populations began to decline, at first rather slowly, but by the 70s and 80s quite rapidly. And as they declined, many of these institutions were closed. And nowadays, they've largely vanished. They've either faded away and rotted and been demolished, or in some remarkable cases, they've been transformed into some other use. And usually when that happens, their origins as asylums are heavily disguised or whitewashed out of history. So right now, there's a development in North London called Princess Park Manor, named after Princess Di, but that once was Colney Hatch Lunatic Asylum. And the developer didn't allude to that. He said, here's this wonderful Victorian building that's the result of an architectural competition between the best architects of the time. What he didn't tell you is what the architects were competing to build.
Women haven't traditionally come out too well from sort of treatments of mental health and the way they've been seen through history. Why was that, do you think? Why have women sort of been associated with mental health problems?
There's obviously in important ways, this is connected up with masculine power and masculine interpretations of the differences between men and women. To some degree, this gets bound up with diagnoses like hysteria, a name which has its roots in the Greek term for womb. And obviously, if you regard the womb as the source of the trouble, us guys don't have one. So luckily, we're spared that. It's a complicated kind of subject, this connection of madness and gender. It's absolutely the case that women were tended to be seen as possessed of smaller brains, as being less rational, more emotional than their male counterparts, and that obviously had its effects both in theorizing about madness and to some degree in the development of often some quite horrific treatments that were visited on women and not for the most part on men. So in the 19th century, for example, there was a great deal of experimentation from the 1850s onwards with sexual surgery directed at women. And that had only a very small counterpart among their male colleagues. On the other hand, what's rather bizarre about the way in which these male doctors tended to develop alternative theories about why women and men went mad and even different treatments is that if you look at the actual numbers in asylums, the male and female populations are about equal. So in fact, women who were seriously mentally ill didn't outnumber men, and yet these misogynist male doctors found it necessary to come up with different theories and different treatments for male and female patients. It is also the case as we move forward into the 20th century that if you look back at those somatic treatments I talked about earlier, lobotomies were disproportionately visited on female patients. So too was and is ECT. Some people suggest that's because women are more prone to depression than men. But that also is a source of controversy. Why is it that diagnoses of mental illness vary to some degree along gender lines? Men are more prone to being diagnosed with personality disorders than women, for example. So this is a very, very fraught and complicated subject. If we stray away from the physical into the more psychological interpretations of mental illness, if you look at the work of Freud, there too you see, first of all, that most of his most famous patients, the hysterics that he began to treat in the 1890s, were women. People like Anna O and Dora were exemplars of the kinds of patients that he wrote about. And in his theorizing, obviously, where he places questions of the libido, of sexual energy at the and sexual trauma at the center of his theorizing, to some degree, this is a gendered kind of theory. And Freud confessed himself to be extremely puzzled. He said at one point, "What is it that women want?" And he clearly didn't know. And his theories often seem to us now to be reflections of this male bias that we've talked about in other contexts.
That was Professor Andrew Scull of the University of California. His book, Madness in Civilization, A Cultural History of Insanity, is on sale now, published by Thames and Hudson in the UK and Princeton in the US. And Andrew will be speaking on the history of insanity at the Edinburgh International Book Festival on the 18th of August. You can find out more about that at edbookfest.co.uk. Now, regular listeners or readers will know that we're running an ongoing series called Our First World War that charts the history of the conflict through the voices of those who were there. We've now come to July 1915, and here, in an interview with the Imperial War Museum, is Sergeant Jack Dorgan describing how he wrote letters home for other soldiers from the trenches.
I mean, we had a fella in our company who couldn't write, Billy Bacon, Private Billy Bacon. He couldn't write. And, of course, he couldn't read. Now, then, when I found out, I took on the job of writing letters. But I wrote home to his girlfriend, and to whom he had a girlfriend. Bill, he was a big fella. He must have been 6'1" or 6'2". Big, broad, made. A simple type of fella. And I used to write home as if it was him writing. What happened after I got wounded, I don't know. The letters home would stop, you see.
Would you read the letters from the girl?
Oh, I had to. The letters from the girl. Oh, yes. Our father was a publican. He had a pub about his girlfriend in the village of Choppenden, where when I passed after the war, I often thought of calling in, but I never did. I should have, because he died of consumption later, you know, when consumption was prevalent after the war. But I passed the pub, our father was the pub owner. Often thought of inquiring about Billy Bacon.
What about your own writing home?
At home?
What about you writing home? Who did you write to?
I wrote a postcard every day. A field card, they called them field cards. And on one side of a postcard, you'd put the address on. The other side was a list of printed words. Say, I am well, I am not well, I am in hospital, I am not in, and you cross out knots and so on. And I have been wounded, or I have not been wounded. You cross out what applied. And I have received your parcel. I have not received your parcel. I have received your letter. I have not received your letter. And you crossed out what you didn't apply, you know. That was the postcard.
And you'd send that home?
I sent one every day because I had an ample supply and I used to dish them out, you see.
Who did you send it to?
My job being free, I was a suitable NCO to do that. You see, ordinary sergeants and corporals, they were stationary. They would be in one part of the trench the whole time when they were in the trenches. Me, I travelled anywhere, you see. And it was in the daylight hours in the trenches when fellas had most time to write home.
That was Jack Dorgan. You can continue to follow our First World War each month in BBC History magazine. And speaking of the magazine, our August issue is currently on sale. Inside this month's issue, you'll find articles on Hiroshima, the murder of Thomas Becket, Tudor jousting, and many other topics. And as with last month's issue, we're also providing an audio version, which is included in the iPad and iPhone editions, and can also be downloaded for free from the website historyextra.com/August audio. And just before we go, I'd like to remind you about a new app that we've just launched. It's called History Extra Weekly and is your indispensable guide to the week in history, including some of the best content from the History Extra website. It's free to download and is currently available on the iPad and iPhone. Search for History Extra in the App Store to give it a try. Well, that is pretty much it for this week, but do join us next time when we'll be talking about the war in the Pacific, among other things. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.